Before we begin this episode on the boy who harnessed the wind, which is about a natural disaster and a famine that occurred here in Malawi in the year 2002, I wanted to give you an update on a more recent disaster that happened at the beginning of March. And that is Tropical Cyclone Idai, which hit Malawi, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe in the first half of this month, of the month of March 2019. And it has caused an immense amount of flooding. And the worst hit place in the country of Malawi is the Lower Shiri Valley. We do a lot of work there. We partner with about 90 churches in that region. Many of those villages have been destroyed. Many of the homes of people who go to those churches collapsed in the flooding because their brick built homes are put together with mud instead of cement as mortar, and therefore it just washed away. And almost everyone has lost their crop, and we're just within a month or two of the harvest, and it's been completely wiped out, which means that the next year for the people in the Lower Shiri is going to be really difficult as they're without food, as they're rebuilding their homes, and facing a really difficult situation. So we want to share that with you so that you can be praying for the people of Malawi, along with those in Mozambique and Zimbabwe who are also suffering horribly. But we would ask you that you would consider giving to our disaster relief fund. This disaster is not just a short-term disaster of flooding that's occurred and then that's going to go down and everything's going to be okay. This is going to be a long-term disaster, as the flooding has caused food shortages that's going to result in immense hunger situation for the people who are affected. So we are raising a disaster relief fund in order to help people. And I just want to give you an idea of how far your money can go. As we survey the needs that are out there and figure out what you give and what resources we have and how we can meet those needs, I just want to give you a picture of what your money can do and what a little amount really can do. We're talking about people in villages and situations where $20 will feed a family of four for an entire month. And that's just the basic food of maize flour and some vegetables. And hopefully we can throw in there some water purification tablets in order to help them. But that's the kind of thing that we're talking about needing over the next year. So if you're interested in giving towards that disaster relief effort, just head over to gospellife.org/disaster. gospellife.org/disaster, and give to our disaster relief fund to help those who are affected by Cyclone Idai. Without further ado, here is episode 7. Welcome to Gospel Life,
the podcast of Gospel Life Global Missions.
Hi, I'm Josh Hutchins.
And I'm Stacey Lee Hutchins.
And this is Gospel Life, the podcast of Gospel Life Global Missions, with a special edition, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind.
That's right. The movie just came out a week or two ago on Netflix.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind on Netflix, then we should just kind of at the very beginning say, spoiler alert, we're probably going to be talking about the movie and the book, and we might give something away.
We might. Also, if you haven't seen the movie or heard of it, we should probably say that we're talking about it because it happens in Malawi.
Yeah, so this is a popular book that's been out for several years about a boy in Malawi, and I don't think this is a spoiler if you're still listening and haven't heard, but it's about a boy who is struggling through poverty, famine, and different things in Malawi, but he learns to make a windmill and provides electricity for his family. So that's why it's called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, because right. he makes a windmill. And you can see that even in the trailers, so I don't think I'm giving anything away.
No.
But so this is our little discussion, kind of we've got some questions from people on social media about the movie, people who've seen it, but also kind of some of our reflections on the movie, living mm-hmm. here, having read the book and watched the movie now, just kind of talking about our reflections.
Yeah. We actually watched the movie first and then frantically read the book because we wanted to learn more. And a lot,
which is kind of weird. Let me say this, that this book is a best-selling book and it's about Malawi and neither of us had ever gotten around to reading it. It was on the like to-do list, but we hadn't done it.
Yeah.
Which is strange that we actually moved here without reading The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people say that you should read the book version of a movie first, but I find a lot of times with true stories, if I watch a movie or something about it, it makes me want to learn more. And so watching the movie made me want to read the book even more so I could learn more details and stuff. So don't feel like, oh, I can't watch the movie until I slug through the book.
I think that it's easier to watch a movie sometimes before reading the book when it comes to historical events like this one, because I don't want to, you know, burst anyone's bubble, but movies aren't history and they're not accurate history. And even this movie was not completely accurate to what actually happened. And so the purpose of a movie is to enjoy it and be entertained by it.
Yeah.
And so they condense stories to make a movie entertaining. And there's nothing wrong with that, but just kind of for everybody to know it's a movie. It's not history.
And I do think it helps too. The movie is really well done, yes. I felt like, and really accurate to Malawian life.
Yes.
And I think it helps give you kind of a mental picture as you're reading the book, especially for someone who's never been here, never seen things here. It helps you kind of be able to picture what's going on as you read the book, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. Especially if you don't live here, I can imagine it's hard to kind of picture some of the things that William in the book is talking about in your head. And everything in the movie was, as far as scenery and props, was very, very real to life.
It
felt like a regular day for us here.
Yeah, it was filmed in Malawi. Yeah.
I mean, like right down to the notebooks they were using in school. It was the exact same notebooks that you buy here and everybody uses that are black with the red or the blue spine. Yeah. So that was very accurate. And for us studying language right now, it was very interesting to watch it because a lot of it is in Chichewa and with subtitles. And it was, of course, a lot easier to understand than
very
regular
simple,
Chichewa
clear.
Speakers.
Yeah. I looked this up after we watched the movie and the girl/woman who plays the older sister in mm-hmm. the movie is Malawian. And the rest of the main actors are Kenyan. Mm. The guy who is the main actor, the dad, who plays the dad, he's also known for 12 Years a Slave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he acted in and directed The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. And he's Kenyan and the boy who plays William.
And he's also the director.
Yes.
Yeah.
The boy who plays William and a few of the other main actors are Kenyan, but then they said, I did read that all of the extras were Malawians.
Yeah. Yeah. So That said, a lot of these actors and actresses aren't Chichewa speakers, but they were speaking Chichewa, which meant they were doing it slightly slower and more clearly.
So we understood
than native
it.
Speakers. Yeah. So it was a little bit easier to understand than day-to-day life here. But overall, the scenery and looking at things, it was very, very accurate.
Incredibly.
And real to life. And I've seen some reviews from Africans on the movie, Malawians and other Africans, and they really appreciate that the movie doesn't either on either extreme, doesn't like over romanticize life in Africa. And on the other hand, doesn't demean Africans and their way of life. It's very much real to life.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but that's really true. It stays right in the middle.
Yeah. That said, as I hinted at before, there are some pretty significant differences between the movie and the book. And if you see the movie, you really got to read the book.
Yeah, you'll want to, I think.
And the book is a very enjoyable read. So get it on Kindle or go order it on Amazon. And I think it'll be one of those books that you won't be able to put down. You'll want to just keep plowing through. But what's some of the things that stuck out for you that was different between movie, book, real life in Malawi?
Well, for one, he has more siblings in real life than they show in the movie.
Which you can understand, you know, in a movie. It's just easy to, you know, kind of condense the family a little bit.
Yeah. And I was really surprised in the book. The whole windmill thing is really more about having electricity in his home. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of trial and error and baby steps here and there. The book or the movie makes it seem like it's all about irrigation for the field. And he builds it and it starts and voila, it's irrigating the fields.
Yeah. In the movie, it's like he does it while the famine is coming to an end and like saves the village with the windmill. And that actually didn't happen that way.
No, it was like years and years after his first windmill that he finally built one for irrigation.
Yeah. But it is true that the famine that occurred in 2001, 2002, motivated him to do that eventually, but it wasn't like that was the solution to the famine at the time.
Yeah.
They really struggled, and scraped by, and that was really something they couldn't put in the movie, I don't think, accurately, just how much like day after day, there was challenge after challenge after challenge for his family to get through that famine until the point where the next harvest was starting to come in and they were able to survive again.
Yeah, he goes into so much more depth and detail about the famine in the book. And it was just heart-wrenching to read.
And perhaps some of our listeners would be helped if we just kind of review how most people in Malawi live and how important their corn crop or maize crop, as they would say here, is to their daily life. So Malawians eat
sima,
which is corn flour with water mixed together. And we've talked about that a little bit on the show before, but that is it. That's like, if you don't have sima, you haven't eaten today in a Malawian mentality. And so most people's sima is from the food that they grow themselves.
From their own gardens.
In their own garden.
Yeah.
And so here, of course, we're in the southern hemisphere. We have dry season, rainy season. You plant around December, and we have rainy season that is running through December, January, February, and we're in March right now. So we're coming to the end of rainy season, and then really starting in April and May is when everything is ready to be harvested. And then you have what you harvested to live on the rest of the year. So if you have a drought or you have a flood where you're not able to harvest, then that creates a kind of long-term problem. It's not just right then. And it's not just in terms of like our farmers in the U.S. when they have a bad crop, that hurts them financially, but they're going to eat. Here, if you have a failed crop, you're not going to eat.
Yeah.
You're waiting until that next harvest to come around to really get back to a sound footing. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened in the movie and in the book. In real life, was there was a flood and then a famine. So one harvest fails and things are getting worse and worse and worse as they're getting lower and lower and lower on food until the next harvest, the next year starts to come in.
And one thing that can help people during a time of famine, like he talks about in the movie and the book, is that the government can often sell people some maize for a reduced price. And I think you understand how that works a little bit better than I do, right?
A little bit. And I'm still learning every day about this. And it changes from time to time with different government administrations. But you'll see this in the movie, and he talks a lot more about it in the book. The government was basically in 2001, 2002, during that famine, they were in denial that there was a crisis. Mm-hmm. And the president refused to believe that at the time, President Maluzi refused to believe that there was actually a famine going on in Malawi. And he delayed and delayed and delayed before he declared a national emergency and began releasing the aid and things that people needed. But there was a really compounded problem in that the government stockpiles maize for purposes of emergencies. And the government had, under the advice of the International Monetary Fund, sold that maize. And so they had a very low amount, if any at all. And then they were having to figure out how to import maize into the country to sell at a subsidized rate to help people survive when Malawi wasn't the only country in the region that was having a famine. Mm-hmm. And so this was having to be bought and shipped into the country through other countries that were also having problems. So it was really a big mess. But in your typical set up for most of Malawi's history, the government subsidizes farmers, just like the U.S. government subsidizes its farmers and its crops. The government here subsidizes farmers, but of course here farmers are much smaller outfits than big industrial farming in the United States. Here, what happens is the government subsidizes seed and fertilizer for people to buy. And it's still very expensive for people. And people are always asking to borrow money to be able to buy their seed and fertilizer and things. But at the time that this happened, the boy who harnessed the wind happened, the government had suspended that program under advice of Western governments that subsidized their farmers, but thought that it was a good idea that Malawi not subsidize their farmers. It was a very complicated issue that was, there's a lot of players involved with the foreign donors from the West and the United Nations and the Malawian government. And a lot of it came down to the problems of President Maluzi's lack of leadership. He was a businessman. He was a city man. He didn't really fully understand farmers, a lot of people say. So he didn't stress agriculture and didn't respond quick enough when there was a problem.
Hmm. Well, do you have any other thoughts about the movie and the book before we get into our questions?
Yeah, I thought that one thing the movie didn't get into that was very important in the book, and I understand why the movie didn't do this, was the importance of magic in Malawian society.
Oh, yeah.
And that's something that was kind of hinted at in the movie, because you kept seeing the Gule Wamkulu, which just means the big dance. But in the movie, from the very like opening scenes and then throughout, kind of sprinkled throughout, you see the masked dancers.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the only hint at something supernatural or magical in the movie.
It doesn't really explain.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't explain what they are. And it is completely positive in the movie.
Yeah.
Whereas William in the book talks about how fearful he was of the Gule Wamkulu. Mm-hmm. And of course, this goes back to African religion and African animism and the traditional religion of the Chewa people. And there's a lot of fear involved in that, especially younger boys like William would have been, who aren't initiated into the secrets of the religion. But anyways, I found it interesting that there was only that hint of magic in the movie, whereas in the book, the very first lines of the book are about magic. Mm-hmm. And so this is just the first paragraph. Before I discovered the miracles of science, magic ruled the world. Magic and its many mysteries were a presence that hovered about constantly, giving me my earliest memory as a boy, the time my father saved me from the certain death, became a hero he is today. And then he goes in to tell a story about when this merchant had lost a package of bubble gum, and he and some other boys found it and chewed all the bubble gum. And the merchant went to the witch doctor and had a curse placed on whoever stole the gum, and came back searching and told them, and how fearful William was that something bad was going to happen to him because of this curse that was placed on him. And I thought it was just a perfect illustration of the way most people live their lives here. Mm-hmm. There's fear of spiritual powers, and there's the use of that fear specifically in revenge between one another when you feel like someone has done something wrong to you.
Yeah.
And it becomes this cycle. So then you turn to magic again, and there's greater fear, and then there's revenge, and then there's magic. And it's this complete system that rules the life of so many Malawians. Mm-hmm. That was completely absent in the movie.
Yeah.
But what helped William was that his family had kind of broken that cycle. Even though he grew up in this environment, his father had a genuine conversion to Christianity. He talks a lot about his father's story long before his parents were married, and how he was a partier and a drinker and really this kind of wild guy who was living a city life, and then turned to Jesus and was changed, and how his dad then wasn't fearful of the magic and helped him to not be fearful of magic either, which kind of opened the door for him to turn to learning and science the way that he did, in learning how to make the windmill and how electricity works.
Well, you ready to get into our question?
Sure.
All right. So the first question we got was that, is this place where they lived at all close to us?
No.
Not really.
It's north of La Longue, and you can look on a map and find La Longue and go a little bit north and find Kasungu, which is the kind of like the county seat, if we're talking in American terms, of the county that his village is in, the village of Wimbe.
And so, it's about an hour north of La Longue, right?
I'm guessing. And we're a ways from La Longue. We've never even been there.
We're like 3 hours from La Longue.
So that's central Malawi. We live in southern Malawi.
Yeah. So, and to follow up with that question, no, we haven't seen the wind turbines that he made because they're pretty far away and we don't really have any plans to go visit them either.
Yeah. I mean, if we're passing through, maybe we'll swing by or something. Yeah. One day.
If we have a reason to go that far north,
we might go exploring one day up there. But I think that some of the people who watch the movie might get the impression that what he did caught on. So now there's like all these windmills all over Africa, all over Malawi. No, is that hasn't happened. It was just kind of him.
Yeah, it would be great. It would be a fantastic system. I have a feeling that the startup cost for someone to get their own windmill would be too much, don't you think?
Yeah, I think if everyone started raiding junkyards for parts like he did, then we'd
and had
run
the
out
brains
and,
to put it together.
But if we're talking about actually mass producing windmills, then I don't know how far you would get without subsidizing that substantially for people to be able to access.
It would be too expensive for regular people.
There are a lot of NGOs that are working with solar, and this gets into one of our other questions. Mm-hmm. What other tools or technologies would improve the nation of Malawi? I think that was from my brother-in-law, Mark. Yeah. Shout out to Mark in Orlando. There's a lot of NGOs that are working with solar to create solar pumps to irrigate crops. And that is really probably a better system long term than windmills because it has the potential to be a lot lower cost. Because solar is just... it's really in the beginnings of its stages, even though it's in some senses been around for a long time, they're really starting to develop it in a serious way now. So by the time that they start really producing solar panels and things in a much cheaper way and at a higher production level, then it'll become more and more affordable in the years ahead. And so solar is really seen as the thing that's going to light up sub-Saharan Africa more than even running power lines to all the villages and things. And if solar can then be tied to irrigation, then that has a big possible impact for people.
That'd be huge. Yeah.
Because as it talks about in the book and as it kind of hints at in the movie, the thing about irrigation is not just that you can irrigate at times when there's famine. The real importance of irrigation is that you can get a second crop in the year. Mm-hmm. And so if you're getting a second crop, not only are you feeding your family, but you're also have the opportunity to sell that and make some money and really give your family a leg up. Whereas right now, when you're just depending on the rains, that's just once a year. And so only one crop a year.
Only one chance for a good crop a year.
Only one chance.
Not even a guaranteed crop every year. We had a question, do most Malawians know about this story? And I have asked around. And so I asked our tutor. We have a tutor who comes. She's a Malawian graduate from the college here. She comes 5 days a week and helps me teach the kids. And I asked her if she knew about the story, and she said she did, and that it's become more popular since the book and the movie have come out. More people are learning about it. But she's also a very city Malawian and well-educated. Where we live, so we live in Zombo, which is a college town, but we're kind of on the outskirts of it. And the people who live around us are really more village type. They're not city people. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, they're living a lot closer, at least, to the lifestyle that people live in villages.
Even though we're technically in Zombo.
So a lot of them, instead of having a job in an office or something that they go to, they're mainly focusing on farming. And then they might, you know, try to find some day labor jobs, or they might have a profession like a carpenter or something like that. But then farming is really the backbone of what they do, just like people in villages.
Most people around us, in our neighborhood don't have running water, or very limited electricity, wouldn't you say? So, I did ask a couple of people who live around us, and they had no idea. So I feel like the story's probably more.
I asked a couple of people, and one of them had remembered hearing about the windmill like several years ago. And, another one hadn't heard about it at all.
So there you go. I don't know about most Malawians, but that's our very informal survey. I think more city Malawians probably know about
it. Yeah, if you're connected through media and stuff, you probably know. But if not, then if you didn't hear it on the radio when they were talking about it on the radio, then you probably haven't heard about it.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I just accidentally answered our next question, which is, do most people around you live in villages? So sort of yes and no, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But as far as Malawians in general, most Malawians live in villages.
Yeah.
There's 17, 18. Some people are saying after the new census data comes out, 20 million Malawians. And the two largest cities, Lilongwe and Blantyre, might have 1 million people apiece. So that shows you just how large of a population lives in rural villages like William did in the movie.
Yeah. So, yeah, most people do. And most people around us do. Live a more village kind of lifestyle.
And the churches that we partner with and serve here are almost exclusively in villages. I think we have 3 churches in Blantyre. We have about 2 or 3 in Zomba, but most of them are out in the villages. So that's the type of pastors that we try to serve. They're living the kind of lifestyle that you see in the movie and that you read about in the book.
Yeah. And do families in villages still struggle with finances and food like it was portrayed in the movie?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. And in fact, in the last week, we've had a natural disaster in Malawi that is going to create the same kind of circumstances that you saw in the movie. We had what do they call them here? Not hurricanes.
Cyclone.
Tropical cyclone. That cyclone hit southern Malawi, hit Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Madagascar. And it caused great flooding in southern Malawi, especially in the Lower Shiri, where we work with about 90 churches in the Lower Shiri. And we're hearing reports that there are entire villages that were just washed away by the flooding, crops completely destroyed. So
homes destroyed,
homes,
people killed,
a lot of people who build their homes in villages, they use bricks, but they use mud as mortar instead of concrete. And so it just, the rain when it's heavy will just wash it out. So that creates not just an immediate problem of people having issues with housing, but a long-term problem that they don't have their harvest now. And so for the next year, they don't have food, and they're going to be depending on government, United Nations and other entities to come in and try to help them through until they have their next harvest.
Yeah. And even, just even around here, which, like we said, you know, it's mid-March and harvest is in April or May, right? My girls came in the other day. They'd been out in the street playing with some friends, and they said there was a girl out there who was crying. She said they didn't have any food. They hadn't eaten in three meals. So, I mean, that's happening even just on our street.
Yeah, that happens in a normal year. Where
things are fine. Because we haven't had flooding or famine here in Zomba.
Yeah.
And that still happens.
But you're at the end of your supply from the previous year, and now you're having to really ration it.
Yeah.
To get it to the point where you have enough until you harvest again. And right now, people are eating what's called doe, which is green corn. So the corn is just getting ripe enough that it's still soft. It hasn't gotten hard yet. So it's more like our American sweet corn.
Yeah.
Although it's not sweet. But they are starting to eat that in order to get through
to the
until
harvest.
The full mature ears of corn are ready to harvest.
Yeah. He talks about that in the book. It's not in the movie.
Yeah.
But he does talk about doe in the book.
Yeah.
And then the last question, which you've kind of touched on a little bit, but, and you'll be more qualified to answer this than I am, is, has the political system here changed since this happened?
Sort of. So in the movie, one of the most difficult scenes is when there's a rally with the president, who they, I don't know if they use his actual name or how they handled that. I can't remember, but, historically it would have been President Maluzi. And the chief of his village, Chief Wimbe, tries to draw the president's attention to the fact that the people are suffering and they need help because of famine. And then some of the president's thugs take the chief out behind the rally and beat him up. And eventually, from those wounds, he dies. And when I saw that, I was really curious as to how historically accurate that was. And according to William's book, it's fairly accurate, except that it seems like in real life, Chief Wimbe, he didn't die as immediately as it seemed like in the movie, but that's a movie for you.
But I don't think he ever fully recovered from it either.
Yeah, he never fully recovered from the beating he received. So to put that in context of Malawian history, Malawi gained its independence from Great Britain in 1964, actually July 6, 1964. So Malawian Independence Day is 2 days after American Independence Day. And for the first several decades from 1964 until 1994, Malawi was a dictatorship under one president, Kamuzu Banda. And he was a very interesting guy, and I won't go into that. He's kind of an eccentric guy. And he was, on the one hand, very good and loving towards his people, and on the other hand, very oppressive to anybody who dissented against him and his policies. But in 1994, he finally stepped down after there was great opposition to him. And so that was when Malawi became a democracy. And in 1994, they elected President Maluzu, was the first democratically elected president of Malawi. And in Malawi, there's a 5-year term for presidents. And so, and he was elected in 1994. And then what happens in the movie and the book is at towards the end of his second term as president. So President Maluzi was kind of a transitional figure in that he was a democratically elected president. And so he wasn't able to be as oppressive as Kamuzu Banda was in squashing opposition. But some of those methods that had been used for decades were still around. And Maluzu had in his party what was called the Young Democrats, which were his thugs that went around and kind of tried to intimidate people into submitting to him and not opposing him. But he failed to be reelected to a third term. In fact, it's illegal to be reelected to a third term, but he tried to change the law and Parliament wouldn't do it. And that was all happening, interestingly enough, at the same time as this famine. He was trying to change the law to get elected to a third term. After him, President Bingu wa Mutharika, it looks like Mutharika, but obviously
Mutharika. The TH makes it. Yeah.
And the current president of Malawi is his brother, Bingu's brother. So Peter is the president now. But anyways, today Malawi is really considered one of the healthiest democracies in sub-Saharan Africa because it has had several changes of presidents where they have been democratically elected. And of course, there's always questions about how free and fair those elections are. And there's an election coming up in May for the next president. It's very competitive. There's a lot of candidates involved, and there's a lot of, sometimes I ask people who do you think is going to win? And there's a lot of disagreement about who is going to win. But there's also suspicion that the election could be stolen instead of actually being fair. But I'd say overall, the violence that you saw in that time period has become more of an anomaly now. I wouldn't say that it's completely absent, although I haven't read anything on the news, but it wouldn't surprise me either.
There was the Cashgate scandal a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's a whole nother can of worms.
Yeah, but that, it was that a guy who got beat up for...
That has to do with, yeah, corruption and a lot of things. And there was a guy who was shot.
There's a lot of corruption.
Yeah, but that was kind of inner circle politics kind of going on. That wasn't just like the regular people suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
Like we saw in the movie. But overall... Malawi seems to be a very healthy democracy right now, and hopefully that continues to be the case and it continues to be an example to other African countries of a country that can have a sound handover of power like we have in the U.S. for over 200 years now.
Yeah.
That said, kind of wrapping up, I just want to kind of give a little bit of a disclaimer. I think that movies can be really great in kind of helping us be aware of problems and some inspiring stories. And this really is an inspiring story. But the danger is that movies like this can often oversimplify things for us so that we think that we know all the answers to a particular problem. And I think, for example, of the kind of the genre of movies about inner city life in the United States, like what are some of those? Freedom Riders, Coach Carter. We could throw Sister Act in there. Of this idea of, okay, these failing inner city schools where all they really need is that tough love teacher to come in and really give it all they've got. And then that's going to really change the community and
just
change
lives.
Turn
the whole thing around.
Yeah. And I think of all the people that probably have seen those movies and they went to college to become a teacher. And then they went into those school settings and they found out, hey, wait, this is a lot more complicated than the movies made it out to be. Yeah. And then they get kind of depressed and question their calling and that kind of thing. And the same thing is true in the genre of movies about Africa. There's plenty of movies about Africa that are inspiring and you think, oh my goodness, this is the answer to poverty in sub-Saharan Africa. Like, the Disney one.
Queen of Katwe
in Uganda, where she learns chess, and that's kind of like her ticket out of poverty and immense poverty in the slums in Uganda. Or one that Americans probably haven't seen, I think it's called The Oldest Kindergartner.
I don't think that's the name of it, but I know which movie you're talking about. It's
a Kenyan film about an old man who goes to kindergarten when he finds out that school's now free in Kenya. And it just kind of gives this idea that education is this simple fix for the economy. And it's a great movie and it's inspiring, but there's just limitations to movies. Mm-hmm. And I just want people to know that, like, the solution to problems in Malawi is not for everyone to build a windmill. Like, that's not a quick, easy fix. And as Americans, we're a fix it society. And a lot of times we're very ignorant about the complexities of situations around the world. And so we come to something and we think, oh, we can fix this with this one thing.
Yeah.
And it's just not that simple. And so I really encourage people to watch the movie, yes, be inspired, but read the book, dig in, try to learn and try to understand that this is a really complex situation. And be in prayer about how your gifts and your callings could contribute to helping people here or another place in the world where people are in need and they need help, but it's not necessarily going to be easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Gospel Life Go.
God provides for the needs of Gospel Life through your prayers and gifts. To become a prayer or giving partner, go to gospellife.org.
We hope you join us in glorifying God by growing disciples who make disciples. We hope that you live a gospel life.